You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The conventional wisdom is that the current face of the American conservative movement began in the wake of the Vietnam War as a backlash against the social radicalism of the 1960s and a burgeoning liberal agenda. But in fact, that brand of U.S. conservatism took root much earlier as a reaction by a group of wealthy businessmen against FDR and the New Deal. This complex history is the subject of a new book called Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. It's published by NYU professor Kim Phillips Fine, and it is published by Norton. I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Fine to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Invisible Hands, would you say that the process of founding the modern conservative movement in this country was a clandestine operation?
Well, I think clandestine isn't exactly the right word, since these businessmen were acting in public. All the records, or many of the records, are publicly available, which I used to write the book. It's not clandestine, but it is behind the scenes, and it is a mobilization of people who aren't kind of in front of the public, who aren't making speeches, who aren't always, who aren't the public face of the movement. That's the subject of the book.
Haven't there always been conservatives in this country? What distinguishes the conservatives you've written about from the earlier variety?
That's a great question. Well, I think that the key is that the modern version of the conservative movement, I think, really does have to be seen as a reaction against the New Deal. Even though, of course, business people have always been active in politics, there is a long-standing, although for a long time people didn't really see it this way, but there is a kind of long-standing conservative politics in this country, embodied by the South, by social Darwinist philosophies. Nonetheless, I think the modern version of the conservative movement really begins as a reaction against the New Deal. And that's kind of when, and you can see that's when the politicians, the ideas, the organizations that even today dominate much of the conservative scene, really you can trace their roots back to that moment in the 30s, that moment of defeat for conservative principles. In some ways, before then, laissez-faire ideas had been the dominant ideas of the country. And what happens in the New Deal is they suffer a profound collapse, really. And so since then, there's been an effort to kind of rehabilitate them in one way or another. And that's, I think, a lot of the history of the modern conservative movement can be understood that way.
An attempt to dismantle everything that the New Deal put in place. But we've had a number of Republican presidents since the New Deal was enacted, and they didn't do it. And it wasn't until Ronald Reagan that a real attempt was made.
Well, that's in some ways testament to the, the depth of the changes brought about by the New Deal. Eisenhower, even Nixon, kind of were working within the basic framework of the New Deal. They weren't able to, mount that type of challenge to it. And there was a real split in the Republican Party.
In fact, Tom Wicker has called Richard Nixon the last liberal president because he was living within the rules of the New Deal, whether he objected to some of them or not.
Yeah, and also he was pushed by the country, by the upheavals within the country at the time, to in some ways go further even than the New Deal, with the Environmental Protection Agency and the creation of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, those types of measures.
Now, you said at the beginning that this is really something that was organized by business people, not by politicians.
Well, I think, in a lot of ways, in some ways, the point about the Republican Party is important. In the 40s and 50s and early 60s, there is a deep split within the Republican Party, and the dominant wing of it is, they call themselves modern Republicans, and they accept the basic tenets of New Deal liberalism in a lot of ways. But there is kind of outside the party, and I think there is this organizing effort in which business people play a leading role. And they feel they have to work outside of the political system. I think that's another kind of key thing about the book, is that oftentimes when we think about politics, we focus only on elections. But in some ways, elections are kind of the top layer, and underneath, kind of geologic changes or something, there are these changes happening beneath the surface. And the election is kind of the earthquake, but underneath there are the seismic you know, the movements of plates that precede the earthquake in a way.
Well, politicians in Congress understood that FDR had received a very serious mandate, and to object too much was going to really make them look like outsiders.
Right.
So they tried to work within the system to some degree. It was these outsiders who could try to organize. And how long before they started actually having much of an impact?
Well, I think there are – well, there's a couple ways to measure their impact. One is I think even before you start to see kind of results in the electoral realm, you see kind of the creation of successful organizations like the American Enterprise Institute, originally the American Enterprise Association, which starts in the 40s, grows in the 50s, and really advances a sustained critique of New Deal economics throughout those years. And also kind of in the realm of labor relations, you find companies like General Electric, which have a very anti-union program. There's a major strike in 1946 at GE, which the company loses. In 1960, there's another one. The company wins. The strike crumbles within a couple weeks. So in some ways, you see this program kind of advancing and coalescing even before it starts to have electoral results. And then, you know, in the 60s, you know, Barry Goldwater, his campaign for the presidency, while it obviously, you know, he lost quite badly, it still reflected the growing strength of this mobilization.
Because that reflected something else that was going on. Although these people were organizing against FDR's policies and calling it socialism, mm-hmm. and anytime any proposal after that that had a New Deal smell to it, it was automatically labeled socialism. Really, the Republican Party had moved in another direction after World War II, hadn't it? It had become the conservatism was a Cold War conservatism, the mm-hmm. William F. Buckley, Joe McCarthy conservatism. It wasn't until Barry Goldwater came along that the economic aspects of conservatism came back full force
into the Republican Party. Yeah, I think that Goldwater is the first kind of national political figure who brings those principles back to the forefront. And yeah, I think it's important. It's not just about the threat that someone like Goldwater described is not, you know, it's not when he's talking about socialism, he's not talking about communist spies. He's not talking about the possibility of a military conflict, or he's not talking about those things alone. He's really arguing that any type of economic liberalism, the minimum wage, labor unions, the welfare state, all of these are sort of the real threat that, you know, that he felt people needed to be concerned about.
So when FDR was proposing the New Deal, what did these business people do to combat it?
Well, one effort described in the book, led by the DuPont brothers, was the creation of the American Liberty League. And the Liberty League is an interesting group because it was in some ways the first top-down populist organization created in response to the New Deal.
Although, in 1934, very early.
Very early. The DuPonts, even though they had been kind of quietly accepting or even mildly supportive of FDR in the election, they quickly realized that he was taking the country in directions they did not want to go and started this organization, the Liberty League. And the Liberty League claimed to be, what was really distinct about it is that it claimed to be a group composed of people from all walks of life. It did not advertise itself as a business organization. They said, we will accept anybody who objects to the New Deal on principle, that we feel the New Deal is violating the Constitution, it is creating social disorder and chaos, and people who want to kind of get behind, you know, resisting it, everybody should come to us. And they claimed that they had many members from all walks of life. In reality, the group was tightly financed by executives. They really did a lot of outreach to executives. And it, in truth, it was a businessman's organization in deep ways.
Did they offer alternative plans to the New Deal?
The main plan, they had no clear plan for ending the Depression, I think. I mean, it was really a negative program. I mean, I think the program for ending the Depression was, you know, people said it wasn't as bad as, you know, it was, people thought it was, that if you, you know, downturns are an inevitable part of a capitalist economy. We have to just ride it out. It will lead to growth in the future.
This sounds like what we're hearing today.
Very much so. That the New Deal, that Social Security will wind up burning the economy even more. All of the New Deal is actually creating the depression, that businesses aren't investing because of the government programs, all of these types of arguments. But in reality, they had no real alternative program for ending the depression, which is part of why they failed so miserably in attracting public support.
My guest is Kim Phillips Fine, assistant professor at New York University's Gallatin School, where she teaches 20th century American history. Her book, Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan, is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Kim Phillips Fine. Her book, Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan, published by Norton. All of these groups were not all that effective, were they? It seems to me that the only real opposition that FDR faced, serious opposition, was in the Supreme Court. And that led to his stacking plan, which failed.
Yeah, these groups failed miserably in resisting the New Deal during the 30s. Their significance is largely in the way that they helped galvanize a group of people who then were prepared to continue to resist the New Deal, in the years after the war.
So they start the equivalent of think tanks. The American Enterprise, for example, is still a functioning think tank.
Mm-hmm.
And names start popping up that we've heard ever since. Jasper Crane, who was a DuPont chemical executive, is credited with promoting Friedrich von Hayek's theories concerning free market economic thought. Were they having much of an impact then?
Well, the Crane and Hayek and the Mont Pelerin Society, the organization that they worked together to build, kind of grows during the 40s and 50s, and it actually is also still around today. And I think it doesn't so much – they don't have an impact right away. I mean, in some ways, one of the striking things about this story is that they – these businessmen and intellectuals that they work with create a kind of network during the 50s that doesn't win right away. It doesn't kind of take root right away, but it generates – it provides the community and it kind of generates the support for – a clear economic program that then, many years later comes to power.
But would it have reached many people? Would many people have responded positively to this message during the Depression? After all, unemployment remained high throughout most of the 30s. There was a huge gap between the rich and the poor. And I would assume that opponents of the New Deal were really not getting through to the bulk of the American public with their message.
Not at all. I mean, I think in the 30s it fails miserably, and it really, in many ways, I mean, this agenda kind of takes hold of the imagination, the political imagination of the public, really only in the 70s. And it really takes quite a long time before it's able to gain, to become successful in national elections. And it really takes a couple of different things. I mean, first, the breakdown of Keynesian economics and of liberal economics during the 70s and the recessions of that decade. It takes the joining of this movement to the backlash against the civil rights movement. And finally, I think especially kind of with regard to labor unions, this program and these businessmen were able to kind of target what was in many ways the most important source of support for a liberal and Keynesian economic agenda. And so in a lot of ways, they were able to kind of, through undermining the labor movement, effectively dismantle one of the main forces of opposition that they faced. And so when you have this crisis in the 70s, they emerge as the people with the ideas and the finances to get their agenda through.
But even earlier, there were people who were popularizing conservative ideas.
Mm-hmm.
William F. Buckley Jr., for example, Ayn Rand, later Clarence Mannion, who you call a pioneer in the field of right-wing talk radio.
Yeah.
Were they involved with the same sort of thinking, or were they offshoots? Ayn Rand doesn't seem to me to be, and William F. Buckley was very much a Cold War kind of conservative, more than an economic conservative, wouldn't you say?
In a lot of ways, although I think the National Review does have a very strong kind of, it has a very strong component, which is sort of anti-government and pro-free market. Buckley's thought is, you know, it diverges in certain important ways, but that is one significant strand of National Review. And also, even aside from Buckley's own ideas, the financing for National Review comes in part from people like Roger Milliken, who's a Yale-educated textile factory owner who closes his plant rather than bargain with a union that wins an election there, and is, you know, a major supporter of Barry Goldwater and kind of deeply embedded in this scene. So even if the ideas are different, the network of money and personal relationships that helps create these conservative institutions, I think, is, you know, coming out of this anti-New Deal group.
A listener, John from Bradley Beach, left a comment on our show page. He said, I was told that Richard Viguerie copied by hand all of the donors to Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign, and then he went on to contact them and build up the first the list that would help him when they were pushing for Ronald Reagan to run for president.
Yes, yes. Viguerie is a new right activist who has the idea to do exactly that, use the contributors to the Goldwater campaign as sort of a base to build a conservative movement in the 70s.
And where do the Christian conservatives come into this story?
Well, I think the Christian conservatives, another kind of under-recognized aspect of the mobilization of the Christian right in the 70s, is the extent to which it too kind of shared this anti-government ideology.
Going all the way back to the 30s? Because it didn't have same-sex marriage or abortion or some of the other issues that have mobilized it more recently as an attractive of a large voter base.
Yes. No, I think in the 70s, the Christian right really does get mobilized during the 70s. There are some earlier efforts, which I talk about in the book, which are really driven by business people to find ways to say that, to kind of bridge the gap between Christianity and capitalism, and to find ways to make the case that Christianity is really, you know, pro-capitalist. There's nothing in it about helping the poor or creating a more just society or any of that, that it really is. There's no tension between being a good business person and being a good Christian. So there are these sort of early efforts to do that and to try to organize ministers to oppose the New Deal. But the Christian right really gets off the ground, I would say, much more in the 70s. And it is, you know, it is driven in large part by kind of cultural reaction. But one of the questions is, how did these Christian activists come to work with business activists? How did these two groups come together, since they might appear to be opposed in many ways?
Thomas Franks pointed out in his book about Kansas.
Exactly. Or even, you know, the Christians are opposed to, you know, overly sexualized advertising, for example, whereas the morality of the market, there is really no morality. It's a question of taste. So, and I think one of the things that I was surprised to discover in my research in kind of Christian conservative publications is the way in which leaders like Jerry Falwell really identify with conservative economic principles as well. There's a lot of material that's kind of anti-union about the New York City fiscal crisis and the irresponsibility of liberal government, about Milton Friedman and Capitalism and Freedom, his book. There's a way in which leaders like Falwell really identify their movement with conservative economic principles. And I think that type of choice is what helps the two groups work together.
Well, what about the other side? What about the economic conservatives? Did they start taking on all of these other social issues as part of their cause?
Not all of them, but some of them. For example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which grows dramatically during the 70s, organizing business against the new social regulations, environmental and health and safety. There's a way in which they see the counterculture of the 60s and the new left as a real challenge to business, in a similar way that the New Deal had been, that these kind of radical social movements are articulating a philosophy that's critical of capitalism and critical of business, and they, you know, run articles in their publications about the need to find ways to recapture traditional morality, not because it's, you know, not really so much because it's, you know, morally right, but because they think it'll be better for business.
Is Ronald Reagan's presidency generally considered to be the high point of this conservative movement?
Some people see it that way. I mean, I would make the case that George W. Bush is really, you know, in a lot of ways does represent the culmination of this movement. I know a lot of conservatives have recently tried to make the case that Bush wasn't really a conservative or—
Because,
you know,
he grew government so much.
Because he grew government or because he didn't kind of return to conservative, you know, first principles of, you know, of conserving things in a Burkean sense. But I think he really does embody a lot of the, you know, in terms of his attempts to dismantle Social Security, to cut taxes sharply, and his unabashed, you know, support for business and the private sector in all circumstances, whether or not it's appropriate. I think he does represent the conservative tradition.
Well, they're trying to distance themselves from him because he left the White House incredibly unpopular. But
like Herbert Hoover.
But Ronald Reagan also had very low poll ratings at the end of his presidency. Mm-hmm. And since then, there have been people who proposed putting him up on Mount Rushmore along with Washington, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, and FDR.
Well, Reagan did. I mean, I think, you know, Reagan's presidency is a presidency like FDR's in that it shifted the entire language of politics in the country and the whole framework and way that we think about the market and government, I think, really was transformed during the Reagan years. I mean, so Bush is maybe the culmination of this, but the Reagan Revolution is a real revolution in the way we approach politics and the market, and, you know, it starts then.
Before I start getting a lot of angry mail, FDR is not on Mount Rushmore. It's Thomas Jefferson. I know that there are people typing away right now saying, Leonard, you blew it again. Well, are we still engaged in this debate? Because there's been a lot of talk about trying to develop some kind of bipartisanship mm-hmm. in Washington, and that's obviously not working. Are the arguments that we're hearing against this economic bailout plan the same sorts of arguments we would have heard in the past?
Yes. I think the Republican opposition to the stimulus package borrows heavily from the same types of anti-New Deal arguments. I mean, you even hear people talking about how it's going to, you know, represent socialism or something like that. I think at the same time, I guess in a lot of ways, I think if the Obama administration does take steps that are kind of even more dramatic than the stimulus package, you know, things like passing the Employee Free Choice Act, which would make it easier for unions to organize, if there is an effort to create kind of a true universal healthcare system, I think we will kind of see a sharp backlash against it, led by some of these same business groups, which are much stronger now than they were during the 30s. There is this whole infrastructure that's kind of poised and ready to fight back. At the same time, I would also say that the Obama administration itself, I think, is in many ways working within a framework of, you know, acceptance of kind of free market principles. I don't really see it as identical to FDR. Or for all the talk of a new deal, I think we are still some ways from an actual new deal.
Well, there has been a certain amount of dismantling of the old new deal. Mm-hmm. But wasn't it a major setback for these critics when the attempt to dismantle the Social Security system were rebuffed so strongly?
It absolutely was. I mean, I think the attempts to dismantle these programs has never been able to really win the popular support that its advocates, you know, would like to see.
Even though Americans have voted very strongly for people who go along with many of these ideas.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting— even though there has been, you know, that electoral pattern, in reality there is, I think, just a deep basis of support for Social Security and other parts of the New Deal infrastructure.
Kim Phillips-Fine is an assistant professor at New York University's Gallatin School. She's written Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.